This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host today, Matt Schaefer-Powell. So, it's no surprise anymore to learn you can really make a fool of yourself on social media. All those crazy tweets, racy selfies, and snarky comments might have seemed like a good idea at the time, but can you lose your job over it? What if you work in a government office? What if you're a student at a public school or a teacher? It seems like every new form of social media brings with it a new set of legal questions, but they all seem to kind of center around this basic constitutional theme. How far do our First Amendment rights extend to the things we say, do, and show online? Today's guest on Dialogue spends a lot of time thinking about that question. Chris McCarty is a Knoxville attorney and speaker who specializes in employment law, education law, and civil litigation. Chris, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, before we get going, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea to kind of bring us up to speed as where we are in terms of social media. I mean, most of the people listening, I'm sure right now, know what Facebook is, probably know what Twitter is, but there's a lot more going on than that.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, I think you hear a lot of reports about the death of Facebook is coming soon. But if you check the stats, I mean, Facebook still has about 900 million, and I did say that correctly, 900 million active users or unique users a month. The next closest is going to be Twitter, and that's about 300. I mean, so you're talking Facebook is still triple what, you know, Twitter is. And, you know, you hear about these big ones like Instagram and Pinterest. I mean, if we still look at MySpace as getting about 40 million unique users a month. Instagram and Pinterest are around 80 million. So, I mean, even MySpace, which we think of as dead, is
I was going to say, I hadn't heard anything about MySpace in ages.
I mean, Facebook is still king, and I think there's no question about that. I think what we are seeing, though, and this has been the trend for a while, if you follow the demographics, is that Facebook's largest growing demographic for a number of years has been women between about 50 and 70. And what we say to that is it's the mothers, and if you're going towards 70, maybe the grandmothers getting on Facebook because they want to see pictures. They want to see their grandkids. They want to see nieces and nephews, and they get on there. Well, unfortunately, as we all know, just like shopping malls, if mothers and grandmothers start showing up, kids start not wanting to show up. So we're seeing kids jump off Facebook. I mean, I was talking to my cousin the other day, who's a young girl, she's in high school, and you know, she'll tell you she only gets on Facebook really to check what I'm doing or check what my sister, who's 40, is doing. And otherwise, she's on Snapchat or she's on Instagram or she's on Pinterest. She's just not getting on Facebook. It's not cool anymore.
We were talking about this on the phone the other day about how I was listening to American Top 40 on Sunday, and as Ryan Seacrest was signing off, he said something to the effect of, keep in touch, we're on Twitter, you can Snapchat us on Instagram. He didn't mention Facebook. I just found that kind of interesting.
It's still the behemoth in the room. Don't get me wrong. When you're at 900 million and everybody else is trying to play catch up and you're still on most of the smartphones that people are looking at, you're still very powerful. But I think what we're seeing, and I think what Facebook's scared of, if you read a lot of that stuff, is, you know, their demographics are certainly trending older. You know, and as we know, advertisers don't necessarily like those demographics as much as the young kids with a lot of disposable income.
So when we talk about some of these other social media formats, what's Snapchat? What happens with Snapchat? What does that look like?
I'm going to sound old now when I try to explain that. I mean, my understanding of Snapchat and just playing around with it, because we have to know about it just from our end and how it works, and if we see it in a case or we see it come up with a client. You know, it's a way to send a picture. It's a way to send messages that instantly go away.
So like within 10 seconds or something?
I think you can set it. Sometimes within like about 5 seconds, I think. But quickly send the picture and then it goes away. So it's not stored anywhere. There's the concept of it's something that, you know, they always say if you put it on the internet, it's always there. Well, Snapchat kind of goes away from that. There has been some debate as to whether actually Snapchat is keeping those images somewhere in a server. And I haven't seen anybody come out and officially say, yes, they're kept or no, they're not kept. But in terms of on your phone, that picture is not on your phone. If it gets sent to you, it's immediately deleted and it goes away.
Okay. And then Instagram?
Instagram, you know, again, it's more of a photo sharing, website, more of a photo sharing social media site in which, you know, I can post photos, I can manipulate those photos, add different effects to them, have fun with them, and obviously put captions on there. But it's really everything on Instagram, unlike Facebook, even though Facebook maybe has gone that way, is very photo centric. Everything kind of goes from the photos out. Again, the manipulation of and just messing with the photos.
And then the last one I was going to ask about is Pinterest.
I wish I understood Pinterest. I definitely don't think I make the demographic of Pinterest. But my understanding of Pinterest is, you know, and you can share recipes on Pinterest. You pin certain things to your Pinterest, and maybe it's a recipe on this, and maybe it's a different things that maybe you're interested in. And it's a way to share those things in a communal way.
Now, we are here today to talk about some of the other things that people do that maybe might not be quite as wise as posting right. a recipe or pinning a recipe.
Yeah.
Are there ways that people are using those particular formats, the ones we were just talking about, Instagram or Snapchatting, mm-hmm. in ways that are unwise as well? I mean, we think about Facebook mm-hmm. and we think about mm-hmm. Twitter, things like bullying, cyberbullying, and, yeah. and things like that. Are people also using some of these other formats in the same kind of way?
If they are, I'm not seeing it as much. Mm-hmm. And I can only speak there, when I'm talking about the legal issues of it, if a client brings it to me, if a school system who I represent brings it to me, or if a private employer brings it to me, I'm seeing more Facebook, I'm seeing more Twitter. I really don't see MySpace anymore, so I don't know who these 40 million people are, but I don't run into them. But if you look at Pinterest, I don't think Pinterest, you're going to run into those problems as much. Now, Snapchat, I mean, bluntly, again, I think one of the concepts of Snapchat and the reason kids like it is because their parents couldn't probably open it up and figure out what's been sent to them.
Sure.
I mean, it is literally something that goes away. So for that reason, too, we don't really see kids get caught with it. We don't really see employees get caught with it. Because it is a vanishing, it's almost like writing in invisible ink.
Is there, you mentioned that we don't really know, there's some discussion as to whether those images truly do disappear. And we've kind of grasped this idea over the last 10 years or so that everything is permanent
sure.
on the internet. So could that be giving people who use Snapchat maybe a false sense of security?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because we haven't gone down that road yet. I mean, if mm-hmm. let's just go to something different for a second. Topics is not really social media, but it's a way, honestly, if people get on Topics, and I think it was recently on This American Life, a big story about it, and it's something that I run into a lot. And on Topics, one of the concepts is, like the news channel used to be, it's anonymous posting. And you can go on there and just literally just unload on people.
Mm-hmm, right.
Well, that sounds good in theory if you can literally keep your anonymous tag and nobody has a clue who you are. But the problem with that is once courts get involved and once subpoenas start flying, then Topics is not going to defend you as the free user. They're going to start handing out your tagline. They're going to hand out your IP address, which has a geographic setting to it. They're going to start, if you've used your real name, they're going to start handing out your name. And what we're seeing is, especially with Topics and some of these anonymous postings, is people are filing suit, maybe what we call a John Doe lawsuit or something, not knowing who the defendant is yet. They're using that to get subpoena power. They're getting those names, and they're suing those people for slander or for libel. So we're seeing that. And I think that's what I would worry about if I was a kid on Snapchat is, yeah, it's not on your phone. It's not here where you can get it because it immediately goes away. But what's happening at the corporate office? Is it something that someone could subpoena? I don't think we've seen that tested yet because Snapchat really is a very new technology.
When you went to law school, you learned about slander and libel. How has it changed since that time?
Because I think it just like everything else, it's had to figure out the new generation. I mean, what we're doing now is we're using laws that came into play literally in the King's Court in about the 1500s, and we're making them apply to Pinterest. We're making them apply to Facebook. And they still work. I mean, the basic concepts, and that's what I tell people that a lot. I mean, just because we have something that's on the internet now doesn't mean the same real world rules don't apply. I mean, they still do. I mean, what I tell people is, if you wouldn't do it at Walmart, you probably shouldn't do it on the internet. Okay. And that's a general rule. Now, unfortunately,
I've seen some crazy things at Walmart too.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I mean, some of the emails that I've been forwarded tell me that I don't have the same taste at Walmart that others do, but I think that should also act as your guide. I mean, maybe you're that person that's just fine wearing that outfit you just wore to Walmart
yeah.
on Facebook. Maybe you're not, but you need to make that decision because at the end of the day, and what the courts say about internet is very much what the rest of us think, is that it's just like the real world. It just happens to be in cyberspace. So if you're sharing something, it's out there. And it's literally something that a guy in, Mongolia can access if he's got a Wi-Fi. And mm-hmm. and you just got to be thinking about that. You got to be thinking about what your privacy settings are and all those things. And yes, if you say something that is slanderous, that is untrue, that is false about somebody, that damages them. I mean, let's say you say something about a guy and that causes him, maybe somebody he's going to work for, somebody he's applying to work with, to read that post, and he doesn't get that job. Well, if that job's going to pay him $70,000 a year, and he can tie it somehow back and prove that your slanderous lying comment caused him not to get the job, then you could be on the hook for $70,000. I mean,
wow.
It's literally, you got to prove some sort of damage. But I think in today's day and age, you could do that, especially in small communities where people are going to know other people. you're going to have those really Kevin Bacon connections are a lot less than six.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, you know, you got to watch what you say. I mean, there are consequences. This you talked about it on the lead-in, but the concept of free speech sounds great, but it's never protected lying. It's never protected lewd comments, obscene comments. I mean, if you lie about me and it damages me, I can come, you know, I'll come take your house if I can prove it. And,
right.
And I'm not going to hesitate to do that. And again, that sounds litigious, but it's a big deal. The reputation that we have in society, and especially in the professional world or out there amongst parents or amongst your peers, is important to us. And it's the old saying that it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and about an instant to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to let somebody take my reputation away by posting something on Facebook or Instagram for everyone else to read that's just simply not true. And I think we're seeing more and more citizens stand up to that. And really, that's why I think you're seeing, it's part of the reason that a lot of newspapers and people that have online forums are going away from that anonymous posting format.
Right.
Because they don't want to encourage that. They don't want to be on the hook for it. They don't want to get a million subpoenas to figure out who this person is because they don't want to pay 25 lawyers to work there every day. They'd rather have about two, which is fine. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's a bottom line thing. But when you're posting those things, what I always tell people too is it's a free account a lot of times. You're not paying for a Facebook account. You're not paying for a Gmail account. Well, guess what you get when something's free? Not a lot. So not going to protect you very much. Okay. So if you think that topics is going to go above and beyond or Pinterest is going to go above and beyond to protect your rights when you have a free account, I think you're going to be sorely disappointed.
I think I'd like to take a real quick easy break here for just a moment. We're talking with Chris McCarty, who is a Knoxville attorney, and we're talking about social media. Where do your free speech rights start and end? You can tweet us at WOTFM, send us a dialogue, Facebook message rather, or call us at 974-5050. It's 974-5050, and this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guest, Chris McCarty, and we're talking about social media today. What are your free speech rights when posting and tweeting and pinning and Snapchatting and all the other things you can do online? If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or Facebook, or you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And Chris, before we get into some of these questions that we've already gotten through Twitter, I wanted to ask you, from an employer-employee perspective,
sure,
what are the differences between working for a private employer and working for, say, a government office?
In terms of what we, again, use as that loose term of free speech rights, in terms of what you can do, what you can't do as an employee, I think the simple way to put that is it's night and day different. At the end of the day, if you work for the government, and I don't care if that's on a state level, a local level, a federal level, that they're still the government. And any action the government takes is going to have some due process attached to it, is going to have things that they have to always be upholding the Constitution and in the way in which they conduct themselves, period. So say, for example, I'll give you a real world example from a case, a very famous case in which a teacher, this is pre-internet, so we're going to go away from social media for a second, but the same rules still apply. So a teacher
writes, was a world pre-internet?
My son doesn't believe that, but I promise it's true. So a teacher writes a letter to the editor and complains about the school board budget. Mm-hmm. Well, that's his employer, and he complains about it, so they take disciplinary action against him. Goes all the way to the Supreme Court and says, no, I've got a free speech right as a citizen of that community to complain about how the governing body of the school board is conducting its business. And the Supreme Court agreed. Okay, and he's right. You have a free speech right as a citizen to criticize the government. So that's very different. That's a switch to a private enterprise for a second. Let's say I want to go in and I want to criticize my boss, who works at who knows what company, Private Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to call him a scumbag and an adulterer and things of that nature. There's absolutely no free speech in that whatsoever. And again, we go back to, there is no free speech even in a public sector there because slander, libel, those things are never protected. But it's just very different. In a private enterprise, and Tennessee is an at-will state, and what I think is always important to that is that's a simple way of saying in Tennessee, if you're a private employee, you can be fired for cause or no cause. And as long as it's not discriminatory, I could come in tomorrow and say, hey, I don't like the color of your shoestrings, and you're gone. And that's how it works. That's private enterprise. You know, school systems, other places are very different. You know, with teachers, you have tenure rights, and we just have contractual relationships. We have due process that we have to think about that applies to governmental action. It's just a lot more complicated. One's a kiddie pool, the other's the ocean.
Well, one of the questions we had through Twitter, our Twitter account, at WUOTFM, my company does have a social media policy, but it's pretty vague and undefined, except it does state that tweets and accounts are considered owned by the company. Two questions. Could the company be legally liable for a tweet they perceived as offensive to groups or individuals? Mm-hmm. And also, do companies actually own their employees' professional Twitter accounts?
That's a really good question, and it's something that's actually already being litigated. There was a big case that people were following called the Phone Dog, which I love the names of internet companies, but just in general, that is literally the name, Phone Dog versus Kravitz. And essentially, it was going back to the second question. It was the concept of an employee had about 18,000 followers, and what he would use that Twitter account for when he worked for Phone Dog was to promote the website, was to promote the company, okay. And it was a review site. And he left, and the question became, are those followers his, or are those followers Phone Dog's? And Phone Dog literally sued him and said, you've taken our customers. You've taken people away from us that you wouldn't have otherwise had. But for us, it's the equivalent of a customer list. And they actually try, and this is the really interesting part of that is, and I don't know how in the world they came up with these numbers, but I'm sure there's some sort of a psychic somewhere that told them this, but they tried to literally monetize what a Twitter follower was. And in that case, I think their complaint and some of their pleadings, they monetized it at about $2.50 a month per follower was what they were saying he was costing them by taking those followers away. Now, we'll tell you, since then, that's been settled. So a lot of us that are kind of, you know, social media law nerds that wanted to watch this, you know, play out, we didn't get our outcome because they settled the case.
You didn't get closure on it.
No, closure. I will say, I do believe Mr. Kravitz still gets to keep his name. I have no idea what happened with his followers, but there was some sort of an out-of-court settlement on that. Now, so it's an unanswered question is what I would tell you.
If it's a personal Twitter account, what are the employer's rights there?
It's very different. I mean, let's go back to that case. I'll put my psychic hat on for a second.
Sure.
I don't really think Phone Dog had a great case there. I mean, my understanding of Mr. Kravitz's, his Twitter handle was basically his name. It's going to be really hard for you to go into court and say, that's mine. Now, if I go to work for Xbox and I go, my Twitter name is now Xbox Guy, I think I'm going to have a really hard time keeping that handle once I leave. And again, that's something that came about. I'm using it. They're probably expecting if I'm in the PR department, if I'm in the marketing department, that's probably part of my job is to tweet like that. And I will add one real quickly that I think is important that I think a lot of people don't know. Even if you have a personal account, let's say it's a Twitter account or a Facebook account, and you're posting things about your company. Let's say you're posting things and promoting the company. So positive comments. The employer needs to know about those things because technically that's an FCC violation if that employee is not saying, hey, I work for Private Inc. Okay. If you're promoting your company and you work for them and you're in any way compensated by them, either as a contractor or as an employee, you have to say somewhere on that site, maybe not the individual post, and there's a debate about this, but somewhere like on your Facebook page.
Maybe in the profile or something like that.
That you work there. So if you're not doing that, then the FCC technically could fine the company for using some sort of inappropriate advertising.
Is there a precedent for that? Has the FCC attempted that?
Oh, no, that's the case. I mean, that's the rules right now that we deal with those regulations. Now, the FCC, to my knowledge, has not been tested on that yet.
Okay.
And the FCC is often tested and in recent years has lost some big tests. But at the end of the day, that is as it currently stands, that's what we tell our clients, that if your employees are posting positive things about your company, you need to make sure those employees know somewhere they've got to say, hey, I work there. It can't just be this phantom marketing tool that people are using. And it really comes from a good place as to what the FCC is doing. Some would argue it's an overreaction to apply that everything, but what was happening was companies were hiring these phantom posters, these phantom reviewers.
Oh, sure, right.
And that's still happening. I mean, on Yelp, I can assure you I would be willing to bet my law license, which probably isn't worth that much if we're being honest, but I'd be willing to bet my law license there's some people on there that are possibly getting paid by some of the companies they're reviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And what the FCC is trying to do is combat that a little bit.
Yeah.
That they want there to at least be some sort of a veiled consequence to doing that, because that's not the point of those sites. That's not the point of advertising. I mean, it's one thing if you watch a Coca-Cola commercial on TV that we know that if it's a Super Bowl ad, they've paid about $2 million to put it in my face. I know then I can judge it differently. But if I go on Yelp to get comments from somebody I assume is just another patron, I want to assume that's real. I want that to be real. Otherwise, that's false advertising. And I think that's why the FCC is kind of jumping in on that.
You know, when we're talking about the concept of ownership, of course, we're talking about professional accounts and that sort of thing. But I'm wondering, when we talk about hardware, and here's what I'm getting at. If somebody is tweeting something, they might have their own account, their own free account.
Sure.
But they're doing it on a company-owned computer, or let's, like you said, it's a difference with government. Let's say they work for the state of Tennessee,
sure,
and they're tweeting from their personal account on a office-owned computer or using office-owned hardware. Does that change the dynamic a little bit in terms of what rights they might have?
Completely. I mean, the simple way of putting that is completely. And what I tell people there is follow the money. You know, if you didn't pay for it, there's a pretty good chance you don't have a privacy right in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not continuing to pay for it, the Supreme Court's actually already addressed this, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Kwan versus City of Ontario. And I'm not going to go all law school dork here on you and go completely in that case. But what's important about that case is, well, one little funny part of that is, by the time it gets to the court, it's about alphanumeric pagers, which I really think just illustrates how slowly we work.
Holy cow.
Yeah, alphanumeric pagers.
I had to remember for a second what they were.
It's a pager that you can text with.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that's how slowly the court systems work and figure these things out. I mean, it literally took years and years to get to them, but it's the same concept. So, I mean, basically this police department in Ontario, California, owned these alphanumeric pagers, handed them out to police officers, and one of the police officers was using it to text a mistress. And when he got caught doing that, he got in trouble because she also happened to be another employee. And I do believe he might have ended up getting divorced. I'm not completely sure about that. But he didn't really like that. He didn't really like that they could look at his texts and look at some of the things he had sent. And he argued, well, that's mine. What the court came back, and it was a 9-0 decision, which, by the way, if you have Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg agreeing on anything but where to go to dinner,
right,
then it's pretty rare. Okay,
yeah.
So we're
yeah.
talking about something that is pretty a strong opinion. A 9-0 decision comes back from the court and basically says, look, If the company owns it, if the municipality owns the equipment, and they tell you you don't have a privacy right interest in it. And in this case, they did it two ways. One, they put it in their handbook. They put it in their policies that said, look, if you use these pagers, they're ours. Please understand that we can look at them. Please understand that we can look at the contents. The other thing they did is they would have these roll call meetings, and the lieutenants and the supervisors, these police officers, would say that quite often. And they were able to show in that case that we were telling them over and over again, and in simpler terms, you don't have an expectation of privacy. And that is that phrase we've always heard with privacy rights, which is reasonable expectation of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go back to your original question. If I am on a computer that I didn't pay for, that I don't pay for the internet, to come to it, and my email address says, mine says at Lewis Thomason, which is where I work, then chances are I don't have a privacy interest in that, and it's really not reasonable of me to believe that I do.
Yeah.
You know, it's the equivalent, and when I talk about it, I say, you know, using your employer's computers and using your employer's email address to do things that you expect are private is like showering in a glass house and expecting people aren't going to see you naked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's just not how it works. Buy some brick. So and the way to do that is get a Gmail account, do things from your home computer. Just don't be doing private stuff on a work computer if you want it to stay private.
What about the time of day? Does that matter? Because it's your expected time that you're at work, even if it's your own phone, it's your own data plan, it's all this stuff, but it's 2:30 on a Wednesday.
Sure. Not the answer to that question again is probably not really. And again, I keep it to the simpler terms of if I use my phone at home as well. Let's say it's a work phone.
Mm-hmm.
That work phone is still my employer's property.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm using that work phone and doing something inappropriate with it and they want to search it, they want to pull the contents of it, et cetera, they can do that. And again, I've just got to know. And now, one thing I've got to make sure that I'm putting an emphasis on here is I am assuming that employers are telling their employees, hey, we're going to do that. You do have an obligation as the employer to make that known. You have an obligation to set their expectation or lack of expectation of privacy by putting it in your policy manual. And always now that, again, flipping back again to the employee, a lot of employees say, well, I don't read that. Well, bluntly, that's your own fault. If you sign something,
maybe you should start.
Yeah. If you sign something and it says you read it, the court's going to basically say, guess what? You read it. And that's how it works. And that seems crazy nowadays because we all sign those iTunes or, terms of service, which are 35 pages long.
And nobody seems to read them.
We all flip to the end and we hit yes. Guess what? That's still a signature. And they're going to assume that you read paragraph 37. That's just the name of the game. And it's always worked that way. You know, and it goes back to what I said earlier, which is just because we have the internet doesn't mean that contracts have changed. Contracts have been working the same way, give or take, since about 1500. And when that's the case, if just because it's printed on a Word program or printed on a blog and you have to do an e-signature, it's still a contract. It's still binding. You're still going to have assumed to have read those things and do what they say.
One of the questions we also had from Twitter, and I don't have it up on the screen right now, but had to do with when you're leaving a job, sort of cleaning out. First of all, is there such a thing? I mean, can you really kind of clean out your accounts? Or
yes and no. I would tell you to be careful, and it's going to be case by case. That sounds like a lawyer answer, right? I mean, it depends. We say that a lot. What I would say to that is you got to know what you're doing, okay? And you got to know what the expectations are, not even of privacy, but let's say you're somebody that comes in as a pretty high level, let's say pharmaceutical sales. I can almost bet you you're going to sign a non-compete. And when you sign that non-compete, one of the things it's going to say nowadays is, you know, you're going to return all of our property to us. And the really smart ones nowadays also say that includes electronic information. Mm-hmm. Electronic information is going to be your files, going to be your emails. So cleaning out those things or deleting them technically would, in some instances, be destruction of their property. So you got to really be careful with that. I mean, you don't want it to look like, and it really raises a suspicion. I mean, let's go back to if you're in a customer-driven world, which a lot of private enterprise is, mm-hmm. you got to be careful doing those things when you're leaving your job because you don't want it to seem like, even if you didn't do this, you don't want it to seem like you went in there, cleared everything out because you're taking customer lists or you're taking client info. You're taking
it looks bad.
Yeah, it looks really bad. You might not have done it, but now you're going to have to prove to them a negative. And it's really hard to prove a negative because you've already deleted everything. And you don't want to do that. You know, you're better off a lot of times just leaving it. It's their property. Bring them the laptop, drop it on your boss's desk after you've said something nice and friendly and not burned a bridge and just take out of there. And that goes back to what we said earlier. I think what makes people nervous about that is a lot of people are using their work email addresses and their work computer for private functions. Mm-hmm. They're using it for private purposes. I just think that in general is a bad idea. What you want to have, again, is a private email account. You know, have something separate from your work account. You know, have a Gmail, have a Yahoo. And by the way, Google's not paying me to say that. I just think it's a smart thing to do. I wish they were, though. Google, you're welcome to pay me to say anything.
If they're listening, if you're listening right now, Google.
I'll take that anytime.
And I did mess up the question a little bit now that we have it on the screen in front of it. It's actually when you're unemployed and looking, what amount of cleaning up of your social media accounts should you be doing?
A lot. I would say a lot, depending on what you're doing anyway. I mean, if you look at my social media accounts, and again, I hope you're really bored and you're trying to go to sleep, it's not anything interesting because I'm always aware of that stuff. I'm always aware of my privacy settings. I'm not going to have to do any cleaning up, and I'm not saying that in a bragging way. This is what I do, so I'm probably a little paranoid. You know, I use social media as a way in which to talk to my friends. You're only going to see it if you're one of my friends that I've deemed somebody that's either I've accepted the invite from or I've invited to be my friend. And you're really just going to find out that I go to a lot of kids' baseball games because my son plays baseball.
Yeah.
And I think my daughter's really cute because, quite frankly, she is.
Yeah.
So in that situation, you know, I'm not worried about it. But, yeah, if you're going out every night and you're getting, plastered and you're 24 years old and you want a high-level job, let's go back to pharmaceutical sales, in which somebody's going to end up paying you six figures, they don't want to pay somebody six figures that's drunk every night and might not show up to work the next day to that meeting with a doctor who could be a $200,000 account. You don't want to do that. And they're not going to trust you to do that if you're going out and acting inappropriately. And what I love people say when I say things like that is they say, well, I have the right to do that. Well, you're right. You do. But you don't have a right to have a job. And that's how that works. That's the give and take. You have a right to do anything you want in this country as long as it's legal. Mm-hmm. Okay, as long as you're not being completely crazy out there. But you don't have a right to somebody to say, you have to give me a job. And that person's not going to trust you with their bread and butter, with their company, with their bottom line, if you're going out there and acting a fool, whether it be in Walmart or, you know, the tin roof.
Well, I'm not endorsing here going out every night and getting drunk and being crazy.
Yeah.
But what happens if, for instance, somebody takes a photo of you, post it on their Twitter account or something like that. Maybe you don't even have a Twitter account, but somebody else posts this. Your boss or your potential employers could still see this. I mean, obviously, the easy answer is go home and watch TV.
Yeah.
But there's nothing illegal about somebody going to a bar, and as long as they're not driving home and they're not fighting or anything like that, there's nothing illegal about them engaging in that activity.
Yeah, and what I would say to that is there are consequences even sometimes to things that we're not responsible for. And that's unfortunate, but that's just kind of how life works. Life is not fair, and it's something that we all learn at some point. It's not really fun. It's not like the Disney Channel. and when we go into your point, though, I've had that case. I've literally had that case more than once where an employer finds out that somebody was somewhere they don't want them to be if they're going to be the VP of operations. Mm-hmm. And you're going to take action based on that because, again, it's not discriminatory. It's an at-will state. I can do that. I can say, I don't trust you anymore because I see where you are. That employee comes back and says, but I didn't take that photo. I didn't post that photo. It doesn't matter. Now, what I think I would add to that is, and I've done this myself, and I please recommend people to do this, is you need to have really good conversations with your friends about those things. I mean, my friends know, period. Don't ever post a photo of me on Facebook unless you show it to me first.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that. I'm a professional. Again, go back to the reputation thing. I'm not saying I have the world's greatest reputation. I like to think I do, but I protect it, and I'm very serious about it. And if you're going to work nowadays, you have to constantly be cognizant of those things. You know, one of the things I think that you should do now, and it's going to sound egotistical to say to do this, but it's important, is you need to Google yourself every now and then. All right, not from a, hey, let's see how many hits I got, but from a, you need to make sure there's nothing out there where somebody's, you know, using your image inappropriately, or somebody's tagged you in a photo you didn't know about, mm-hmm. or somebody is, you know, quite honestly, taking up your likeness or your profession. I mean, I'll go ahead and tell a personal story. That happened to me. Somebody was posing as me and trying to get clients and using a fake email address, and I had to take care of that, and I wouldn't have caught on to that if somebody wouldn't have called my office and told me, hey, you represent me. And I said, I have no idea who you are. And at that
point.
So
you didn't discover it by Googling yourself.
No.
But you could have.
I could have. And, yeah. And really what happened after he said that, I did Google it and I found out where the site was. Mm-hmm. And I immediately took a lot of steps to get it down.
Yeah.
But if you're not always aware that you have an online image and you have this online reputation, whether you want it or not, it's going to come back to bite you nowadays.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guest today is Knoxville attorney Chris McCarty. And, of course, you figured it out. We're talking about social media. Where do your free speech rights start and where do they end? You can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or just call us on the phone, 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guest, Chris McCarty. We're talking about social media today. What are your free speech rights when posting and tweeting and doing all that stuff online? If you have questions or comments, of course, you can catch us on Twitter or Facebook, or you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050, and that's what John did. John, welcome to Dialogue. I don't hear John. I will hear him now. Sorry about that, John.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I tuned in late, so I apologize if you already addressed this.
John, I'm going to jump in here real quickly and ask you to turn down your radio, please.
Okay. Oh.
Well, I can hear the music again.
All right. Do it.
Okay, tell you what, John, why don't you call us back? If you have a question or a comment, call us at 974-5050. John, you can call that number back, too, and we would love to hear what your question is.
John, I'm aching to know, so yeah, please call back.
We're dying to know what your question is. Actually, John had a question about...
Yeah.
We do like your taste in music. John, actually, I do know that John's question had to do with email. So sure. Maybe we can discuss that, too, because we've been talking about social media, mm-hmm. but email is part of that whole conversation. I mean, we're talking about digital information.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes back to what we just said, that most employers now are certainly going to have an email address that is linked to the company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that's a Google corporate account in which they're using a Google server or Google process and interface to have at, you know, again, private.com or wherever. Mm-hmm. Actually, that sounds like a terrible name, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, at that situation, that email address is theirs. And you kind of got to go back, and I think a lot of people don't understand how that works, but you literally are buying a piece of internet real estate when you're buying that domain name. I'm paying for it. I'm going to GoDaddy, and I always love GoDaddy commercials. I always wonder how many people actually know what that is.
What GoDaddy is. I don't think I've ever seen any actual reference to what it is.
You're just supposed to assume that, you know, because Danica uses it, that you should use it too, but nobody has a clue what it is. But it, you know, I've used it, and what you do is you buy a domain name, which could be, again, our domain name and is lewisthomason.com. Mm-hmm. So, our firm actually had to purchase that domain name. We own it. Mm-hmm. So whatever goes through that, be it the email, be it, you know, the website itself, be it content on the website, we own that internet real estate. So at that point, you know, you go back to your privacy policies. I guarantee you that if you have a smart employer, they've put something in your handbook that says that discusses email, discusses hardware, discusses software. Who owns that? Who owns a right to look at it? And generally speaking, it's going to be the employer.
We're going to give John another shot here. John, you're on Dialogue. Welcome to Dialogue. What's your question?
Sorry about that music. It wasn't on my end. You may have touched on this already. I tuned in late, but you were talking about email at work and you're a writer, lack of right to privacy. But I know of a case where a lady had a private online account, as Mr. Mercari recommended, and apparently they used some keystroke capture to learn her password and accessed her online email account. And what are the legalities, ramifications of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks, John. Thanks for calling back, too.
Sure.
And that's a great question, because that's more nuanced than what I was talking about. So let's go down that road a little bit. He mentioned two things that I think are important. One, she had a private account, and two, there was a keystroke program. For those that don't know what a keystroke program is, there's lots of software out there where you can, you know, purchase a keystroke, you know, software monitoring system that can go on employees' computers. Let's say you have let's say you're worried about an employee. Say you're worried about what an employee is doing. Maybe you've had some comments that people have seen some weird things on the employee's screen, et cetera. And they're doing it not on the traditional ways and traditional places you'd put it. Mm-hmm. So they're not saving it on the actual hardware. They're not saving it to your email address that is a link to the company. They're actually being smart, like I said, and using a Gmail. Now, two things there. The employer really doesn't have a right to get the password and access the online account. So let's say you have a Gmail account. If I have a password to that and it's mine, that is my Gmail account. Even if I access it at work, it's mine.
Even if work owns the computer.
Yeah, correct. I mean, because the contents of that email account are somewhere else. If it's a Gmail account, they're probably on some big barge out there in the middle of the mm-hmm. Pacific where they keep their servers.
Where the cloud is.
Right, where the cloud is. Exactly. It's a cloud on the water. So, at that point, that's my property. You don't have a right. I have a privacy interest in it. And essentially, if I've used something which is, got a password to it, that's essentially like locking a door. And the courts look at it that way, that you can't just go into that unless I give you permission to do it. So, yeah, that would be arguably an invasion of privacy. Here's the problem, though. Let's go back to the keystroke. Using a keystroke program, generally speaking, if you're only monitoring software and hardware that is at the employer's disposal, that is owned by the employer, and that the employer has told you they can monitor, then they can a lot of times put that keystroke program on there. Now, I think there's a big misconception about what it does. The employer technically shouldn't be using that to get the password and then go back into the email. What you can do with the keystroke is you can see what has been written on the computer, and that would be perfectly legal. And I know that sounds like a pretty gray area, and it really is. You know, the courts are just figuring that out. They're understanding what keystroke programs are. But really what it comes down to, again, is only what has been typed at that time could be monitored, could be tracked, and the employer can do that. They just can't use that to then go back later and get into the Gmail account and see what else is in there.
We talked before about, when you're talking about a private enterprise, and I'm going to pick on Coke and Pepsi for a second, though. If I work for Coke and somebody takes a picture of me and posts it and I'm drinking a Pepsi, Coke has every right to fire me in that.
Yeah, probably situation. In that situation, especially if you're going to be a higher level. I can't imagine that, you know, they're going to pick their battles. I mean, I can't imagine unless you're a guy literally wearing a Pepsi uniform and somebody takes a picture of you drinking a Coke, that might be bad for their image if it goes viral. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they can do that. Even in a private situation, though, there are some rights that you're going to have. And what we've seen there is the NLRB, which is the National Labor Relations Board. And when a lot of people think of labor, they think, oh, union, it doesn't apply to me. That's not true. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act protects employees from having, you know, the ability to do these things called concerted activities. What is that? Well, have you ever seen Norma Rae and you've seen Sally Field stand up on a table and say, we want the union or whatever that sign said? Mm-hmm. It protects people from going down the road of a union. How do you form a union if you're not yet a union? Well, the way in which you do that is you're protected from having those conversations by Section 7 of the NLRA. Well, the NLRB polices that and basically says you can't stop employees, even if they're private employees, from talking about things that affect their work. We saw a big settlement that came out of the NLRB a couple years ago in Connecticut. There was an ambulance company that an employee had gone on that worked for the ambulance company and was complaining about her supervisor. Not necessarily complaining about him. I think she might have used some vulgar language, but was complaining about him doing his job as a supervisor and how he wasn't fair and how it wasn't good working conditions. Mm-hmm. At that point, she's actually protected in saying that because she's talking about her job. She's talking about those concerted activities that we all go through, our wages, that we aren't paid enough, that we're not given our overtime, maybe things like that that affect the job. If she gets on there and says, my boss is an adulterer, my boss is at the, you know, doing cocaine when he's not, that's not protected. Okay, that's not a concerted activity.
Let me ask you kind of a silly question, though. What if he is an adulterer? What if she actually has proof
sure.
that he's an adulterer and she says she puts it up there and says he's an adulterer?
Sure. That's a great question. I mean, and honestly, the answer to that is he's in a bad state. Okay. Not only is he just been caught.
He should stop doing that.
But what's a funny thing in the law is we have all these defenses and some of them have fancy names and some, again, go back to England in the 1500s, maybe even earlier.
Sure.
But the number one defense and the affirmative defense to a slander or libel claim is the defense of truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you can prove it, you know, I wouldn't recommend that guy sue her is what I would say, yeah. because he doesn't want to go down that road.
Yeah. 974-5050, 974-5050. Chris McCarty is our guest today on Dialogue. And let's go to Kathy. Kathy is calling us from Powell. Kathy, you're on Dialogue. Welcome.
Yes. My question is this. My daughter has a job and the company for about 3 years ago, sent her home with an iPad for her use at home. And I was immediately nervous and suspicious and, frankly, paranoid, and was assured that there was nothing to be concerned about, that not only could she use it at home, but I could, and so could her child and anybody else, and that there would be no problem with it. And I couldn't believe that. So I'm wondering, was I right to be nervous and suspicious and, frankly, paranoid or not?
Well, thank you very much, Kathy.
You're asking a lawyer if it's a good idea to be suspicious. So the answer is always yes. Okay, Kathy, and I don't mean to demean your question. Let's talk about just in general the question of go back to property. That's the company's iPad. They've given it to you to be able to use, just like I can take my laptop home. Yes, I can take it home. Yes, in some situations, the company is going to be fine with your kid getting on there and playing games. And by the way, quick side note, it spooks me out. My son is 6, and it's crazy how good he is at using things like an iPad.
Isn't that nuts?
He has no idea how to use a keyboard, but he's immediately just intuitive, knows how the iPad works. It makes me think Steve Jobs was some sort of being from another planet.
I feel a little bit older right now, too.
Absolutely. But going to your question about that, I guarantee you if the employer was smart about it, they probably had your daughter or who in any situation, whoever this might be, sign an agreement when they took that iPad home that had a lot of language in there that you're going to assume they read. And one of those things probably said, you understand that this is still our property. You understand that we can still monitor this. We can take it back at any time and we can look what's on it. If you're okay doing that, I mean, quite honestly, let's go back to, again, using a personal example. I don't care if you go through my Facebook account. You're just going to find photos of my kids. I'm not doing anything that interesting, bluntly. Mm-hmm. So if you're okay with that, sure. But I will tell you, and this is where people get caught, and I'm certainly not recommending people do criminal activity, but some of the ways in which we're seeing people get caught with things like child pornography, which I'm quite frankly glad they got caught, mm-hmm. and other things that they maybe should or should not have been doing on the internet is a lot of times from the employers. The employers are turning these people in. And then you see the employee on TV just shocked that, I can't believe they got onto my computer and found all this child porn that I was bringing up at 2, after lunch. Well, that's not your computer, first of all. And I think they probably do want to turn you in for that. And am not accusing anybody out there of doing those things to that level. But if you're doing something that you're worried about getting caught with, whether that's illegal or it's just maybe not a good idea, I wouldn't recommend doing it on something owned by the employer.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go to Sally, who's calling from UT. Sally, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I teach psychology to undergraduates at UT, and I'm always looking for new ways to engage them outside of the classroom by drawing links or connections between current events and popular media and the textbook and lecture content that we tackle in class.
Sure.
How do you recommend faculty use Twitter, Facebook, that kind of approach in reaching out to students in a responsible way?
Well, this is great, Sally, because this gives us an opportunity. We've only got a few more minutes left in the show, but gives us an opportunity to talk about sort of the education environment.
So. Yeah, and what I would recommend there to you, Sally, and that's a great question, is there's no limit on how many Facebook accounts you can have, okay? And there's also no limit on what type of Facebook accounts you might want. The way in which we all think of a traditional Facebook account, and I'm using that as an example, Twitter is going to work the same way, Instagram, Pinterest, is you have this one account that's yours, and that is, you know, Chris McCarty's account. Well, I have a good buddy of mine that practices law, and he's very involved, and one of the way he markets, and he's in the Middle Tennessee area, is he uses, you know, social media. That's his primary marketing tool. But he's very good about it because he has a personal page, which only his friends can see, and it's about his kids, and it's about their vacations, etc. Mm-hmm. But he also has a separate page for him that is a fan page in which it is again, uses his name, but it's not accessible. It's more accessible, and it's not going to have personal things on there. It's not going to have his daily activities. Again, he keeps that to just his personal page. So when I talk to educators, you know, one of the things I say, especially if you're using Facebook, if you're going to have your kids communicate with you on there, I think it's smarter to not bring them into the fold of your personal page. Create a fan page. Create it. And again, I don't know your last name, Sally, so I'm just going to say Smith. Let's say it's Miss Smith's psychology classes. You know, you're going to come up with a better name than that. But the fan page. And then they all like it. And you can have a conversation with them. You can have forums. And it, again, still builds that wall, that barrier, which I think is a professional barrier, between you as a person and you as an educator. And it's just a wiser way of doing it. It's what I tell people.
You do a lot of consulting for school districts.
Sure.
You said, what are administrators most worried about? What are they most concerned about right now?
Oh, no question about it. Cyberbullying.
Yeah.
You know, we hear the word bullying, and it's certainly been a catchphrase over the last few years. But I don't think people fully understand how pervasive it is in social
media.
What
does it look like? Tell me, give me, you can make up an example, but
oh, sure.
what does cyberbullying look like?
I mean, I've seen everything from, you know, somebody calling, you know, Nana and a boo-boo to somebody threatening to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a situation one time, and again, we represent a lot of school systems. I'm not going to be specific and certainly telling you where that is. But, you know, of a situation where a parent even says, gets on there and joins in the fray. You know, it's two kids going back and forth. It's one kid threatening to really harm the other one. And the parent says, well, I'm going to drive them to your house to do it, you know. And so we think these, you know, there's a lot of parents out there policing this stuff, but unfortunately it's not always the case. And when we see cyberbullying, the thing I want people to know about that, and the reason educators are bothered by it so much, bullying is bad in general. I think we can all agree on
sure.
that. But the way it used to work, if you got bullied, is you'd go home and you got a safe place. You get to go in your room. You get to turn the lights off, maybe decompress. You get to go give your mom a hug. Okay. Now that stuff follows you home.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you turn on your computer, the moment you have a smartphone and you check it and somebody's blasting you on Twitter or somebody's doing this on Facebook, that room that used to be your safe place to get away from all those things is now the same place and sometimes more pervasive type of bullying than you would have gotten at school. So there's no off switch anymore for these kids. And I think that's what's really scary about it. And I think parents have to really monitor those things. And again, this is something I'm a parent. I have growing children. I'm going to be monitoring it. I don't have all the answers, but I know it's an issue. And I know it's an issue that we all have to be thinking about.
Do we have, should we be thinking about it in terms of free speech, especially if we're talking about school districts making rules that affect, and I'm talking about a public school, making rules about what students can and cannot do online?
Yeah, it's a fine line. I mean, again, the school system, especially a public school system, is the government. We can't take steps, and I think parents get frustrated sometimes when they have a child who's been bullied. I mean, let's go backwards real quick. The state of Tennessee last year enacted, you know, there's zero tolerance offenses. One of the zero tolerance offenses now in the state of Tennessee, on top of having a gun at school or having a knife, is cyberbullying or cyber threats. Mm-hmm. Now, it's got to be more than just calling you a name. It can't just be offensive. But if someone literally uses the internet, whether this is at school or out of school, and they're using the internet as a way to legitimately threaten to harm you, and it's something that you look at as being a substantial or likely threat, then we can actually, school systems can expel that student from school. That's a zero tolerance offense now. And you have to be careful with that. I mean, what I generally tell people is, you know, if it threatens safety, we as a school system, we're generally going to do something about it. And we have to protect our students, because if it's going to cause a substantial disruption at school, if it's going to threaten those kids, we're going to do something. And a lot of the directors and teachers around this area are going to tell you they want to do something. But if it's just offensive, you know, that kid, if they're typing that from their home on Facebook and it just offends, if it's just something that bothers you, maybe it's inappropriate, we as a school system at that point, if that, those are my clients, can't really do much about it. You know, that's going to be on the parent to go in and make sure their kids aren't doing those things. The school system might give that kid and their parents a call and say, hey, do you know this is even happening? But in terms of disciplinary action, it's really hard to do that when, again, it's happening outside of school and that kid still does have a modicum of free speech rights.
This is probably unfair to ask you with only a few seconds left in the show, but how do we as a society and as in the courts, how do we stay on top of this? Because it changes so quickly.
We turn the internet off. Just in general, we just get rid of it. Now, sometimes I want to do that. I really think we keep talking about it. And I know that sounds like a Pollyanna answer to a really complicated question. But if we're not asking these questions, we're not writing articles about it, we're not having an hour-long talk about it like you and I have, we're not staying up on how big of an issue it is and how it's ever-changing. You know, keeping that dialogue going, and I'll give you the free plug there, is important.
Well, good. We are out of time here, unfortunately, on Dialogue. And I want to thank you, Chris McCarty, for joining us today. Thanks to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones, and to Brandon Hollingsworth, who helped us out with our social media. Thank you for listening and calling and sending your questions. If you missed the show today or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so at WUOT.org. And sure, we'll post it on Facebook and Twitter, too. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.